Wouldn't you love to get paid for doing what you love to do? If you're ready to move on to what's next, join us for Circles of Change with Dr. Zara Larson. Our uplifting live talk show on Saturday mornings from 10 to noon will have you circling back, not running in circles, to pull your experience forward in new ways. Advance your career, plus help others with theirs. Join us Saturdays, 10 to noon, right here on 104.1 The Truth, for pragmatic advice and unconventional wisdom. Circles of Change with Dr. Zara Larson, where your path is created by walking on it. Well, here we go with our final segment on Circles of Change, and that commercial right beforehand got my blood going. Welcome on the line, Lisa Napoli. How are you today, Lisa?
Hi, how are you?
Just great. Well, of course, Lisa's going to be one of the featured authors that's coming to town here in Tucson. We're catching her in Los Angeles, so let me give you a brief intro. She's a journalist who has worked in all forms of the media, beginning her career at CNN in Atlanta in the early 80s. She worked in local TV in North Carolina and covered the Clinton campaign and the Waco standoff as a field producer for an early iteration of Fox News. Lisa also has produced shows for an upscale division of QVC called Q2 and covered the early days of the web as the first staff columnist and reporter hired for the New York Times section called Cyber Times. She has served thus as an internet correspondent for MSNBC, writing an accompanying column for MSNBC.com, and most recently served as a reporter and backup host for the public radio show of Marketplace. So she's in good hands here today, or I am, Lisa, with you being with us. In 2006...
I think I can't keep a job.
That's right. No, that's called... that's called intentional career development. Talk about that. Okay. In 2006, she, though, was in the grip of a midlife crisis when a chance encounter led her to the adventure of a lifetime. So leaving behind that job in public radio and life in L.A., she moved to the tiny Himalayan kingdom of Bhutan to volunteer at the country's first youth radio station. And along the way, she found the world is a beautiful and complicated place, and she learned to appreciate life in a way she never imagined. A native of Brooklyn, New York, and a graduate of Hampshire College in Amherst, Massachusetts, Lisa currently lives, as we said, in downtown L.A. and hopes in the second half of her life to be a philanthropist. She sees her proudest accomplishments, in addition to learning to swim at age 37, to frankly be the party she holds every Friday night, where she relishes seeing friends befriend one another. In fact, I interrupted you last night at your party so we could connect, right?
You did. It was just at the beginning, though, and everybody was talking, so it was okay for me.
It was okay for you. Well, I can't wait to actually host you, Lisa, here in Tucson at the end of this week at the Tucson Festival Books, so this is kind of a sneak preview. Did you go on that journey or ever imagined it would then lead you to writing a book about the journey?
Definitely not. I had no idea what would happen. I really didn't have any idea I'd fall in love with Bhutan or go back so many times, and I definitely didn't think I'd write a book. Nope.
That's great.
Absolutely.
How many times have you been back now?
So far, I've been six times.
Six times?
Yeah, for different lengths of time.
And the first time you were there was for how long?
First time I went was for 6 weeks.
Six weeks.
I took an unpaid leave of absence from my job to go volunteer for 6 weeks.
Now, I've got to believe, just even asking for an unpaid leave, whether your current manager there at Marketplace was supportive, but your friends, your family, wasn't everybody saying, are you nuts?
Yeah, people thought it was a little crazy. And I didn't think it was crazy. I mean, crazy might have been picking up and going someplace I'd never been before for good. But I just was going for sort of a teaser to see what it was like there and just to get, more importantly, away from what I was feeling was very much of a treadmill. Mm-hmm. I think everybody felt that at some point in their lives. Mm-hmm. But I was really in the throes of intensely feeling that.
Well, and in fact, your opening introduction of your book was about you trying to grab a hold of positive psychology just to anchor you through what was welling up inside about needing a shift.
Right. Exactly. And that was the invitation to Bhutan came on the heels of going to this positive psychology class. And as you know well, it's all interconnected. It just felt like it was the right thing to do, to take the invitation, even if people were kind of dubious about it around me.
That part of the world, had you ever been to those corners of Asia? I know you're quite well-traveled journalist, but what was different about this one?
No, I'm a journalist who works a lot by phone and internet you know, not a globetrotter at all. I've been to other places, but no, I'd never been to Asia. I vaguely knew where Bhutan was, and that was kind of the fun part for me, was that it wasn't known terrain. It wasn't this place I'd always aspired to go. I don't know that I've ever really aspired to go to any place. I'll go anywhere where somebody says, here, you're invited. And that was the thrill for me. They needed me to do something there, so I went.
That's right. And that do something there was actually something very much in your swim lane, pun intended, since you learned to swim and love to swim, by the way. But the idea of working in radio.
Yes, exactly. So I got this invitation to go help start a radio station in the Kingdom of Bhutan just as it was transitioning to democratic rule. And it was a youth-oriented radio station. So imagine just having to go hang out with a bunch of 20-something-year-olds to help introduce to them radio, because none of them had ever worked in the medium before, because there hadn't been TV until 10 years before.
Well, in fact, they wouldn't even know. Yeah, they wouldn't even know what it looked like anyways.
Yeah, if you gave the average, you know, group of 16-year-olds running around your neighborhood a radio station, they've all mimicked it. You know, they've seen it in movies and TV all their lives and listened to it. But these kids didn't have any point of comparison. So it was a blank slate media-wise, which is very exciting.
And, again, help our listeners understand that the Kingdom of Bhutan, how big is it?
Yeah, okay, I always forget to give my Bhutan 101,
exactly.
So I'm glad you're here to guide me through it. Bhutan is about 650,000 people in a country about the size of Switzerland. What's so unusual about how sequestered it's been from the outside world is that it's sandwiched between India, Nepal, and Tibet. So it's not exactly, you know, out in the South Pacific somewhere. It is in the middle of massive, massive populations, but it is very tiny, and it has for many, many years, it has for centuries kept people out. And in the 70s, the then King of Bhutan decided to start letting people in. And that's when things began to change there. Roads began to be built for the first time. Hard currency was introduced for the first time. I mean, for even today, subsistence farming is kind of the mainstay occupation there. People don't have industrial jobs, manufacturing jobs. They live off the land, even now. So it's a very interesting place, especially for somebody like me who covered technology for many years, to see, because it is really an evolving kingdom in terms of technology, modernization, all coming in right now.
And in a very, very fast way on top of that. Well, I was struck, one of the statistics you comment is there are only 40,000 cars in the entire country. Now, me being an automotive executive, I just can't even imagine that about what life would be without, you know, an automobile. And in fact, your opening chapters of the book, to set the stage, just your first ride in the van sounded absolutely harrowing to get you from the airport to where you were going to live for these 6 weeks.
Yes, and it's amazing to think, Sarah, that it's not just, you know, I'm from New York City, as you said, so
in LA.
You know, not everybody has, and LA, but not every, right, which is the opposite in terms of transportation, but not everybody has a car, you know, and it's a luxury still in this country, even if it is a necessity, but there we're talking places where they don't even have access to a road, much less a car. So it's just to give a sense of how remote many of the villages are. Even today, you walk hours and hours before you get to a road that doesn't take you any place big. So it's kind of a mind-boggling difference to what my life was like in downtown Los Angeles.
I was going to say, it's one of those beam me up, Scotty moments. Like, did I really land here? You know, well, you know, we set the stage here now, obviously, because you grew up so much professionally in the media, and particularly in the news media and in the marketplace media about shifts in business. And of course, covering internet, like you have the explosion, the emergence, the manifestation to couple that with then youth. And the idea of young people not knowing what they don't know, and so why would they know to ask, but yet they move forward. But then the other element that I find fascinating about this environment you stepped in is that they don't measure their progress by GDP, but what's the term again? Gross domestic
happiness.
Happiness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, as Asia's developed over the last 20 years or more into an industrial place, you know, so many of our goods come from Asia, as we all know. Bhutan, again, in the middle of all of that, is sequestered from it. And they refused to sort of march into this capitalist, industrialist frenzy. It's a Buddhist country. And the king years ago offhandedly said, I choose to measure our country's progress in gross national happiness which of course is a very loaded phrase and it's very quaint, but really what he was saying was, I don't want to destroy the well-being of the people at the, you know, I don't want development to come at the expense of the well-being of my people. Mm-hmm. So now, of course, that we've had this financial meltdown, we have all sorts of countries in the world and governments, municipalities, looking at this concept of growth deliberately and with measure and not at the expense of the day-to-day lifestyle of people. What good is it if you develop a community and nobody can go see their kids anymore, or nobody has any time to take care of themselves, or they commute for 3 hours each way every day? So that's what the King of Bhutan was saying years ago, and this gross national happiness thing, which was an offhanded remark, has become something that the social scientists and economists are studying around the world.
Well, and I think also people in their own personal lives are starting to strip away some of this stuff that's crowding away authentic life. You know, just you see the reemergence of community-based activities, the arts, learning in general. It's maybe a return to something that you found, you know, you lived and fell right into in these six trips you've taken.
Well, yeah, no, exactly. And it really came for me at the right moment, though,
yes,
because
in your life,
I was really looking for that. And as you mentioned, I have these parties every Friday. I'm a single woman with no kids, so I didn't have a built-in family infrastructure. I live many thousands of miles away from my biological family. And so for me, creating community, especially in a place, a big, sprawling city like Los Angeles, was, you know, a big goal for me. And I felt proud that I had achieved the creation of a community, mm-hmm. such as it was. But in this country, we're so busy, we're running around, we don't have the time and the pace to accommodate the dropping in of neighbors, et cetera. I mean, I'm sure somebody out there listening is saying, well, that's not true, I don't live that way. But it just seems generally people, especially in their prime working years and childbearing years, they just, it's too busy. So I loved stepping out of my daily life, as nice as my daily life was, and seeing how extraordinarily different other people in the world live. And yet in the end, everybody wants the same thing. Everybody wants love. Everybody wants, you know, comfort, however you define that. Everybody wants something clean to eat and sleep in and, you know, have a roof over their head. But that's really what's key. And this sort of reset that for me, recalibrated.
You know, it's one thing, though, for you to go through some of that personal shock of disengaging from the pace of the other lives you led, but then to reengage in a place that was so totally different, right? I mean, really, really different. I mean, whether it be the food you had access to, the language, although the language or the cultural, the values was so dramatically different.
Yeah, it was. It was, and yet really at its core, you know, you have someone's grandmother is devoutly Buddhist. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I have friends who have grandmothers. I have an aunt who's devoutly Catholic. So the trappings, the specifics were different. But really in the end, that's what I think was so startling to me, that the food was so different, that the day-to-day life really in the end was very similar. That's what I think was so important for me, was to see that in the world is just made up of people who are all striving and struggling for the same things. It just looks different.
Exactly. Lisa, your background in radio then, and you're going over now as a coach and a mentor to help them with the radio. What were the kind of things that you felt you pulled upon the most to guide these young people as they established their station?
Oh, gosh. You know, nothing's our professional.
Okay, yeah.
Completely human. It really was more like being a big sister or a den mother to a bunch of young people who were as curious about me as I was about them. It was just incredible how they grew up learning English. All the kids go to school in English in Bhutan now. And they had pronunciation questions. That was a big part of what I did, was how to pronounce these words, because their elders may not have spoken English comfortably as they did, or they had questions about culture. They'd seen tons and tons of movies, and so they knew I was from Los Angeles and originally from New York, and they didn't really understand where that was, but they wanted to know, what is it that you know, is this life really like that there? Is that what the day to day is? So it was more like being a cultural ambassador.
Which for you, though, of course, you also have your own, I'll call it baggage. I mean that in respect from being part of media. So media, absolutely, we know, is always about repackaging. So did you find yourself between about, you know, not lambasting how you grew up professionally, but rather saying, well, you know, let me give you a slightly broader perspective on this. Did you find that trap?
All the time. I was constantly saying, I mean, my favorite scene in the book when I first arrive is how my host, who's about my age, welcomes me to this apartment that they've rented for me to stay in. And it really was the same size as my apartment at the time in Los Angeles. It wasn't huge. It wasn't small. It was a nice one-bedroom apartment. And he was very apologetic about the kitchen, which was very modest, but it was perfectly serviceable. And I said, really, it's the same size as my place in L.A. And he said, well, no, we've seen Desperate Housewives.
Exactly.
You know what your kitchens look like. And I said, no, that's not what most people's kitchens look like in the United States. I promise, that's TV. But this is a very well, he ended up going to Harvard for some further study. He's a very smart man, but he just really believed that we all had these huge gardens and homes and grandeur, and that was, I felt like it, if nothing else, that was the most important message that I could attempt to convey. Of course, I can, you could say something a lot that doesn't necessarily people believe it, but that was a fantastic part of my experience, and it reframed for me this hypocrisy I was feeling about the media.
Yes, yeah.
I, instead of being angry with the media for passing all of these messages that were untrue, I mean, I certainly was that, it made me appreciate the power of the media to convey good things, too.
Absolutely. And I was going to ask you that, go in that exact direction. So now here you are back in the United States, probably not sliding just right back from where you came from, because Lisa Napoli is a different person now. And so as you think about your role in journalism and writing and so on, did you feel like, wow, I'm really pulling on a whole different, you know, set of tapes in my own mind now?
Oh, absolutely. But I think that happens for anybody when you go on a trip. If you have your eyes open, it changes you. And that's why people travel, right? Some people travel just to go hang out on a beach and relax, which is important. But a lot of us travel because we want to see something different than what our day-to-day life is. And if you're really open and present and taking it in, which hopefully you are, it can't help but influence the way you look at the most mundane aspects of your daily life. And that was the greatest gift for me of this trip. It recast the way I looked at my life. Before, I looked at it as a sense of lack, not of material goods, but I always thought, oh, if only I'd had a husband and I'd had kids and if I'd had a better career and I'd made this happen more. And now all of a sudden it made me think, no, I have so much and I'm so fortunate and there's so much I can do. And it just really reframed the way I look at everything.
That's a lovely experience. You couldn't ask for anything more powerful. For those who may have just turned in, we're speaking with Lisa Napoli. Her book is Radio Shangri-La, What I Learned in Bhutan, The Happiest Kingdom on Earth. And of course, those of you who are Tucson-based can have the opportunity to meet Lisa next weekend. She's here in town for the Festival of Books. And on Saturday, the 12th at 2:30, she and I are actually probably going to repeat some of this chit-chat, but with the benefit of others pitching in at the Koffler Building on Saturday. Lisa, I look here at the incredible list of speaking engagements you have now. In fact, I noticed here on May 20th through the 25th, you're going to be back in Bhutan.
Yeah.
What kind of feedback have you gotten so far from people in the country you've visited then?
Well, you know, Zara, it's really hard to get books or anything sent to Bhutan.
Okay.
So just in the last couple of weeks, actually, I'm sorry, last couple of days, the books have started arriving.
Oh,
and I was so, there's one woman I write extensively about in the book, one of the young women I met at the radio station who's become a very close friend, and she's very, very literate and very culturally aware. And she read the book the other day and gave it 2 thumbs up. So I was very worried because, you know, it's very difficult to convey someone else's culture, and especially a culture that was for so many years closed. Like Bhutan, people, you know, you can offend people. I'm sure I've offended people somewhere about my depictions or impressions of the place, but certainly that wasn't my intention. But, you know, invariably somebody takes issue with the way something is cast. But I was very happy that one of my best friends felt that way, felt positively about how I depicted this moment in time that she was very much a part of. And I'm very interested to see, just as I'm thrilled about coming to Tucson because it just is such an energetic and exciting, even without my being there, I can't believe how the enthusiasm and organization is just so stellar with the Tucson Festival of Books. This festival I'm going to in May in Bhutan is mostly Indian writers. It's organized by India, so that'll be a fascinating contrast to see how they react. And just this whole issue of, you know, you writing a memoir, you and I could have grown up in the same household and written two completely different books about the experience. And that's what's fascinating about this for me, is how people I know will react to how I perceived, what I'm revealing about what I perceived in that those very first visits.
So what has the reaction been to your book so far, now that you're on the world tour here promoting your book?
It's so exciting. There are people, I've had some, you know, people who hate this book, but then most of the people, I've been getting email in the middle of the night from men and women, and I think that the publisher purchased this book thinking it was a woman-oriented book, but I've been getting mail from men, too, who say they started reading it and they couldn't wait to write and tell me that they loved it, and which is what is the biggest honor that you could possibly imagine when you write something, that someone would not only buy it and take the time to read it, but then take time out of their busy lives to sleuth you out and send you a mail saying, this is really resonant for me. So that's a thrill. I mean, as a journalist and as a radio person, print, any medium, it was always a thrill that someone took the time to write to me. Even if they hated something I said, it meant that they paid attention.
That's exactly right, because particularly on radio, you don't even know, is anybody out there listening to me? So like you said, even if it's somebody that calls, as I've gotten, to correct my pronunciation of cacophony, I'm thought, this is cool. I like it. Well, Lisa Napoli, I can't wait to welcome you to Tucson when you arrive here later in the week. Again, for our listeners, the book is Radio Shangri-La, What I Learned in Bhutan, The Happiest Kingdom on Earth. You can go to lisanapoli.com or also radioshangrilathebook.com, or come and see us at 2:30 next Saturday at the University of Arizona. Travel safely, and we're going to see you real soon.
Thank you so much for having me. I can't wait to meet you in person.
Absolutely great. Well, terrific. Thanks a lot, Lisa.
Change is chaotic. That is, unless you embrace it, going places you hadn't dreamed were possible. The Larson Group, Architects of Change, is a leadership consulting, executive coaching, and career transition firm. We help individuals make the most of their current employment situation or to step forward confidently into a career transition. Contact us at thelarsongroup.com or toll-free 1-877-544-2580. The Larson Group, Architects of Change, helping others unleash potential through transformational change. 1-877-544-2580.
Take care. Bye-bye.